Hello and welcome to How Many Geese? I'm Jack Badhams.
And I'm Roddy Shaw.
And if you're looking for a nature podcast that doesn't take itself too seriously,
then we are The Natural Selection.
On today's show.
The highbrow, the writing credits of a lion were lost on me.
I look like something that wallow.
I'm sure they wallow.
Yeah, if they don't, they do now.
I'm going to say four hooves wallow.
Six black swans, four Canada geese, four cranes, two peacocks, seven flamingos, and a marabou stork. The only animal that they ever turned down was a hippopotamus. Listeners, we've covered lots of meaty science and animal behaviour topics before. So we've done deep dives into parasitism, we've done the necrobiome, we've done mutualism behaviour, all sorts of stuff. And if that's the sort of stuff that you come here for, if that's the sort of How Many Geese that you enjoy, then you might want to skip this episode. However, if you do want to learn about the movie described as the most dangerous film ever made, then stick around.
Oh my God. Yes.
So, before we get into the most dangerous film ever made, animal films, what comes to mind?
The Jungle Book.
Jungle Book, yeah.
Lion King.
Yeah.
Finding Nemo.
Yeah. I was going to say, if there's anything in the 2000s, that would be... Yeah. Yes, there's lots of very famous animal films out there, but I am willing to bet that this one that we are going to be talking about, I will be amazed if many of the listeners have heard of this film.
Yeah.
Because until it popped up on a recently viral TikTok video that I saw,
yeah,
I had never heard of this film. And the way you reacted when I said the most dangerous film ever, yep, made makes me think you've heard of it.
Mate, I've watched it.
No!
Yeah.
Have you?
Yeah.
Oh, well, this is great because we're going to be able to do a real dissection of this film then.
Yeah.
So we best make sure we're talking about the same thing. What's the film called?
Mary Poppins.
Yeah, those penguins, man. Those animated penguins.
I've never looked at a chimney sweep the same again.
The answer I'm looking for is...
Raw.
Raw, yes. So it's Raw as in R-O-A-R. But it might as well have been called R-A-W, to be honest. Like Monday Night Raw. So... I'm going to talk, I will talk about the story of this film, and then Roddy, you will be able to add some colour as being someone who's actually watched it, okay? So like I said, I came across this film on a TikTok where somebody was telling part of this story, and it just sounded the most maddest thing I'd ever heard of, so I've gone in and researched it, and that's what we're going to talk about. So, of course, we are in America. Where else could we possibly be? We are in America.
It's that first fork in the road for a How Many Geese story. It's, is it gonna kill you? If yes, choose Australia.
Yeah.
Is it completely deranged? If yes, choose America.
So we are, of course, in America. We are in 1969, where we meet husband and wife duo, Noel Marshall and Tippi Hedren. Tippi is an actress most notable for starring in Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. So evidence of previous work with animals, as well as, yep, the final film of Charlie Chaplin,
huh,
which is a nice little accolade to have. So she's, you know, she's a movie star in 1969. Yeah. They are in 1969. Both of them together are in Mozambique. And in Mozambique, they are filming a movie called Satan's Harvest, which... I didn't do any further research into that one, but, you know, that's what it's called. So she is there as an actor, and her husband, Noel Marshall, is acting as her talent agent. So they're both there together.
Right.
That's the point of this. Right. They're both there together in Mozambique. And near the set of the film, they come across an abandoned house in Gorongosa National Park, which had been taken over by a pride of lions.
Yeah.
So there's just this abandoned house that they have to drive past to get to where they're filming, and there's just these lions hanging around. They were told by local people that African animals were becoming endangered due to poaching, and this stirred something in Noel and Tippi, who wanted to make a film to highlight the plight of African wildlife. But the theme of the sight of those lions in that house really stuck with them.
Yeah.
Listener, make sure you remember that it's about the lions in the house, because that's a major part of what we're going to talk about. So Tippy said, it was an amazing thing to see. The lions were sitting in the windows. They were going in and out of the doors. They were sitting on the verandas. They were on top of the house. They were in front of the house. It was such a unique thing to see. And we thought, for a movie, let's use these great cats as our stars. Mm. What could possibly go wrong? So what was exactly the plan? They had this idea that they wanted to make a film highlighting African wildlife, and they loved this visual of these lions in this abandoned house in Mozambique.
Yeah.
So the plan was, Noel's idea, her husband, was to make a film that incorporated a mixture of slapstick comedy, drama, and, I quote, moments of stark terror in human and animal encounters with the underlying message of preserving African wildlife.
Yeah.
Which is just a sensational, like, twist and turning sentence.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, like, I've never looked at a lion and thought slapstick.
I just love the idea of moments of stark terror in human-animal encounters with the underlying message of preserving African wildlife.
I mean, this is, you know, moments of outright silliness in a podcast with the underlying message that we should look after the natural world. So,
well, actually, yeah, I feel very seen, actually. Yeah. That's a fair point.
I don't think we should cast too many dispersions on his initial vision on how to get people engaged with nature.
We are very much the audio roar of the 21st century. So, to do this, they plan to make a film about a load of lions living in a house alongside people.
Yeah.
They need, without any experience of this whatsoever, they needed to talk to people who actually knew a bit about lions. So they went and spoke to some lion tamers. And all the lion tamers said, that's an absolutely insane idea. And the amount of animals that you're talking about having together, that we just cannot guarantee that you're not going to be ripped to shreds.
Yeah.
Like, that's just, it's way too much. What you're proposing is just dangerous. And any self-respecting lion tamer in the 60s and 70s wasn't going to touch this.
When the career and the profession was at its most, its most resolute. Yeah. Do you know, like I said, I have seen the film. So I've got an idea in my mind, and I'm going to wait till it. But do you know how many they were talking about, like, initially? Were they talking in, like, 500? Was their first pitch to the lion tamers 500? And then they got, like, haggled down to where they...
We will talk about the numbers.
Yes, yeah.
We'll get to that. Yeah, cool. Yeah. So, because it's initially, at this moment, just lions that they're interested in. Right, so as I said, any self-respecting lion tamer thought this was a mad idea, didn't want anything to do with it. Step forward, one guy, Ron Oxley, who knew a bit about lions and suggested that if all these people don't want you using their lions because they quite rightly think that this is a batshit crazy idea, why don't you just get your own lions? Why don't you just, as the people financing this film and with your new passion for cats, why don't you just get your own lions, give them some really basic training, and slowly introduce them to each other in the hope that they get along?
See, that's the kind of energy I want around me when I'm developing a pet project. No naysayers, no sense, logic, regulations. I want nothing other than can-do attitude, even if it flies in the face of all conventional 60s lion-taming wisdom.
Listener, look at the people surrounding you and work out if you've got a Ron Oxley. Because if you don't have a Ron Oxley, you need to get out and find one. Some people might call them enablers. Other people call them motivational wonders.
But we call them Ron Oxleys.
So, like I say, that is exactly what they did. They thought, okay, the only way we're going to be able to make this film is going out there and getting our own lions. So there were very few captive lions in Africa at this point. So they initially wanted to film it in Africa. But actually getting hold of captive lions within Africa was very, very difficult. So they had to film it in America. So Noel and Tippy began to collect lions that they were acquiring from zoos and circuses just in their house, just starting to get lions and bring them into the fold.
Do we have any notes on how old they were?
The lions.
The people.
I don't know how old. That's a good question. I don't know how old they are at this stage, but I'm old enough to know better. I think we're talking sort of 40s, 30s.
Okay.
Because they've got, we'll get onto this, they've got teenage children.
Okay.
So that's where I'm putting them. I'm putting them around that sort of age.
And they've got lion purchasing capital.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so she's been in Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds.
Oh, yeah.
He has been in quite a big film, which we'll come on to in a minute.
Okay.
Because it sort of ties into this.
Okay.
So, Noel and Tippi, they're in their house in America collecting lions from zoos and circuses. The police then found out and asked them if they could please stop doing that because it's, you know, not great and you're going to probably get killed. So they bought some land in California and hired a team to build a big two-story African-inspired house and landscape the gardens to plant certain trees and certain bushes to make it look as much like Tanzania as possible. Around the outside, very, very key, they erected a 14-foot fence to make sure none of the animals got out from the set, and then the stage was set. This was where they were going to film their masterpiece.
Yeah.
So, what exactly was this film going to look like? So, the plot features Noel, remember, one of the two masterminds behind this, playing a naturalist called Hank, who lives on a wildlife reserve in Africa. And his family visits him and are confronted by all these animals. I just realised I could have asked you to summarise it as someone who has actually seen it.
Well, I think the problem you would have encountered that as someone who has actually seen it, the plot was not the bit I remembered.
Would you like to know what the working title was?
Oh, was it sort of Death by Claw?
No. The first working title was called Lions, but it's the second working title that I really like, which is called Lions, Lions and More Lions.
Yeah, that was a really good, like, what do you got, like, market research session, you know, where they sort of had a focus group in a room and it's like, we're thinking lions. And everyone was like, it's not enough lions.
So it then became Lions, Lions and More Lions because the original script was written to feature. So this is what they set out to do without really any experience of filming anything like this. And of just seeing basically some lions in a hollowed out house in Mozambique, which I would say is probably not a good omen for inviting lions into your own home.
Yeah.
But their original script featured between 30 and 40 trained lions. That was what they were setting out to do. However,
and that number was quoted back to them as mad.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That was when they were like, that's, no, you can't do that. That's way too much. No self-respecting lion tamer, unless your name is Ron Oxley, would ever think that this is a good idea.
Yeah, the naysayers.
So, 30 to 40 trained lions was what they set out to do. However, when Noel took in two infant Siberian tigers and an African bull elephant, he decided that he would need to change the name from Lions, Lions and More Lions to Roar, which is, of course, what you've said the film eventually became released as.
Because you'd hate to mislead people. You'd hate to have punters coming out going, oh, Christ, I bought a ticket for Lions, Lions and More Lions, but I swear there was an African bull elephant in the background at some point.
Could you, based on your memory of the film, give me a rundown of any animals you remember seeing in there. Because I've got the list here of what eventually ended up being in the film. So off the top of your head, what animals do you remember seeing in Raw?
I remember lions, lions and more lions.
Yep.
How many different animals have you got in front of you?
One, two and a half, 10, 11, 12, 13.
Lions?
Yeah.
Elephant?
Yeah.
Tiger?
Yeah.
Leopard?
Mm-hmm.
Cheetah?
No, I don't have cheetah.
Okay, mountain lion, like puma?
Yeah.
Okay, five. Giraffe?
No.
I thought that was a giraffe.
Oh, actually, I do think you might be right. I don't know if I wrote that down, but I remember seeing that they had to go and film some like pickup shots in Africa that may have involved a giraffe, but that's not in the set.
Okay, because there's like scenes. I swear, there's shots of like the Serengeti. And,
yeah, yeah. Right, so they did do a bit of filming out in the wild, but no.
Okay, on set,
not in their compound.
You said a half animal. Is it a liger? One of those animal? The other way around, a Tigon.
Yeah.
Okay.
Tigon, a hybrid between a tiger and a lion. Yeah. The rest. Yeah. I think you'd do well to get because there's one more big cat.
Jaguar? No.
Yeah.
Yeah. They had a jaguar.
Yeah. I had two jaguars.
Famously African.
I will give you the full list because the rest we sort of get into miscellaneous birds. But okay. Remember they set off on this journey wanting to include the already mad number of 30 to 40 trained lions.
Yeah.
They ended up with 71 lions, 26.
Yeah, that's what Ron Oxley will do to your project.
71 lions, 26 tigers, a tigon, 9 black panthers, 10 cougars, 2 jaguars, 4 leopards, 2 elephants, 6 black swans, 4 Canada geese, 4 cranes, 2 peacocks, 7 flamingos, and a marabou stork. The only animal that they ever turned down was a hippopotamus. They were offered a hippo and they were like, no, that's where we draw the line.
It's very difficult to comprehend that because I would say that a hippo is equal to 4 to 7 lions.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, they've got 2 elephants.
Well, that too.
I feel like if you've just gone down the route of having 2 elephants and over 100 big cats...
Yeah.
Adding a hippo to that. This is probably the only situation on planet Earth where adding a hippo into the mix wouldn't result in more carnage.
There's no other... Yeah, like a tea party. Add a hippo. Yeah. Carnage.
Yeah.
Circus. Yeah. Add a hippo. Carnage. This movie.
The Indy 500.
Yeah.
Anything. Yeah. The Tour de France.
Exactly. Yeah. The chess grandmaster's final.
Because this was their passion project, and I'm guessing because genuinely an absolutely fucking insane idea, Noel and Tippy cast themselves in the lead roles and their children taking up supporting roles. So it really was like a whole family thing. So Melanie Griffith is plays the daughter, and she was a teenager at the time. So this is the teenage daughter that we're talking about. She's in the film playing the teenage daughter of her actual parents. I should also mention that the rest of the staff on this film were all non-union workers because Noel and Tippy were afraid of, and I quote, breaking union rules, which...
That, to me, screams of Ron Oxley. That's a man who goes, you got a vision, you don't want the union involved.
So, a camera... hasn't even been switched on yet, but they're just collecting more and more animals. By 1973, so we're talking like now 3 or 4 years after getting the idea, they're starting to struggle for funding. So they've not even turned a camera on, and they're starting to struggle to actually just pay the costs of the feed from all the animals that they're collecting. So they'd initially budgeted $3 million for the entire project. But the cost of the crew and the feed for all of their ever-growing number of animals was now reaching $4,000 a week alone, before any other costs. $4,000 a week was just having to go on feeding the animals and the crew as well. So now, this is when the film starts to sort of go from passion project to massive obsession. So they are selling their other houses to pay the debts that are starting to run up on this film. Tippy sells her fur coat given to her by Alfred Hitchcock. But thankfully, Noel had been an executive producer on The Exorcist. And that partially helped them limp along and actually make this film. Without The Exorcist and Noel's involvement in it, it's unlikely that Raw would have ever been made because the money off of that kept them going.
This is like, you could chase this back in such a kind of butterfly effect way of like, without... Was The Exorcist? The Exorcist wasn't Kubrick, was it? But it was someone, wasn't the director of The Exorcist mad, who like fired off shotguns and things in the middle of... Yeah, to get like the sort of screams and everything. I feel like the guy who directed The Exorcist...
If that's true, there is no wonder that like some of this rubbed off on Noel.
It's only a matter of time before someone comes along and goes, why not get 70 lines together?
So, they're limping along now. They're having to sell their other houses. They're selling memorabilia. The Exorcist money is keeping them going. You know, when we started out on this podcast, there are certain lines that I never thought I would say, and the Exorcist money is keeping them going is something that I didn't think we would ever bring into a nature podcast. Yeah. Anyway, they're all the family are now mucking in and helping out. John Marshall, who is one of the kids, is now working as, and his job description is animal wrangler, set mechanic, boom operator, camera operator, and on-site vet. Imagine seeing that job applicant, like that, that job advertisement.
On LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Connect.
Anyway, it's now 1976.
Yeah.
So we're now 6 or 7 years after their initial idea, and the cameras are finally being switched on for a filming schedule that's due to last 6 months. Okay? So they're going to set out to make this in 6 months. But because these are rescued animals that have barely been trained, actual filming, like actually filming them, is a nightmare.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable carnage. The cinematographer, a guy named, and I'm probably going to butcher this, Jan de Bont, JAN DE BONT. I'm going to call him Jan de Bont.
Yeah.
He, to film them, would set up 5 cameras and literally just wait for hours for the cats to do something that could be used in the film.
They're very method.
Yeah. Here's a great sentence. One scene involving 2 tigers riding in a 1937 Chevrolet took 7 weeks to complete because the animal handlers had to train the tigers to ride in a car. So the whole thing was supposed to take them 6 months. They had to spend 7 weeks just trying to film 2 tigers riding in a 1937 Chevrolet.
But the presence of mind to write that scene pre-collecting animals, I'm guessing, to just go, we're doing this, and then find animals that have no business or capacity or training or anything, and then go, 6 month schedule, be fine. It'll be fine.
So because everything was so chaotic, the script was changing all the time, thanks to basically like what the animals were doing.
The laws of nature.
So if the animals did something, they would be like, oh, we could put that in the film. So things like playing with the family's boat or riding a skateboard, they'd just be like, that's cool, let's put that in the film. And this led to some of the lions getting writing credits on the film because they were the ones that were shaping what this film actually looked like so much. So if you go into the credits, some of the lions are named as writers on this film.
Spectacular. Absolutely spectacular.
Now, having watched it, and like you said, the plot was sort of lost on you. The way that it reads is...
It wasn't lost on me, as in I didn't get it.
So you're watching some Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, it's not Tenet or something, or Tenet or whatever Nolan's last one was. It goes forward, backwards, upside down, this full of bullshit. It's not lost on me. The highbrow, the writing credits of a lion were lost on me.
Well, in terms of the plot being hard to follow, the way it reads is just like a load of scenes cobbled together. Like, it just seems like animal does crazy stuff next, animal does crazy stuff next, animal does crazy stuff next.
Yeah.
How they actually film some of this stuff is genuinely insane. So, in one scene, they coated Tippy's face in honey and brought in a leopard to lick it off. And remember, these are animals that are barely trained. Although animal handlers were 8 feet away, there was nothing to stop the leopard biting her face if it wanted. To film chase scenes, the actors would be asked to scream and run away so that the cats would chase them.
It is insane.
Yeah. It's mad. And so, Roddy Shaw and listeners, here's where we get to the really juicy stuff. it is unsurprising that there are lots of injuries related to this film. It has been estimated that Raw's 140-person crew, at least half of them were injured in some way in the making of this film. So let's start with our leading man, Noel Marshall.
Yeah.
He was first bitten through the hand when filming a fight scene with some male lions. And the doctors thought he might lose an arm.
Through the hand.
Yeah.
Bitten through the hand.
Bitten through the hand while filming, and I quote, a fight scene with some male lions.
Yeah.
He got bitten around 11 other times before a lion, which was, and I quote, curious about his anti-reflection makeup, gave him 8 more puncture wounds.
Sure.
Like, I like the thought that the lions are writers, but now they're now, maybe this one took a bit of an interest in the makeup department. He was savaged so much and so often that he got hospitalized with blood poisoning and gangrene.
Like, at what point do you throw... I mean, again, it's Ron Oxley.
He's just in the back. Going, keep going.
He's not going to let you quit. He's not going to let you down. He's there. He believes in you.
So, now to our leading lady, Tippi. Mm. During a promotional shoot, a promo shoot in 1973, things got off to a great start when Cherries the Lion bit her in the head, scraping her skull with her teeth.
I was going to say, I feel like... there's something to do with Tippi Hedren and her scalp coming off.
Yes. So she got, basically her skull got scraped by a lion's teeth. She was scratched on the arm by a leopard, bitten on the chest by a cougar. Oh, and later, the elephant picked her up by the ankle with its trunk, fractured it before throwing her off its back, leaving her with inflammation of the veins, a fractured hand, and you guessed it, gangrene.
It's insane.
It is mad. This was only a few days after the elephant attack. It was only a few days after the elephant had lobbed its trainer into a tree and broken a shoulder.
When was it made? 70s?
This was being shot in the 70s, yeah.
Matt, it was a different time.
Well, the mad thing is, like, this is a family thing. So the next one is their daughter, the teenager. She received 50 stitches after being attacked by a lioness in an incident that required her to have facial reconstruction.
Yeah.
And they're still making it. John Marshall, the son and the jack of all trades that we mentioned, needed 56 stitches after getting bitten in the back of a head by a lion. And then Jerry, another one of their sons, got bitten in the thigh. They were literally all at it. Honestly, the list just keeps going. The cinematographer, Yanderbont, who I should say had worked on, or has since worked on, Die Hard, The Hunt for Red October, Basic Instinct, like proper films. He got scalped by Cherries the Lion and needed 220 stitches.
Isn't it the film with the most injuries of all time?
It's got to be. That's why it's got this tagline as the most dangerous film ever made.
Yeah, yeah.
The assistant director got bitten in the throat and jaw and almost had one of his ears pulled off and had to go to hospital for immediate 4.5 hours of surgery.
That's a point. What do you think the local hospital was like during the filming of this? It's just a revolving door of sort of runners and camera assistants coming in missing limbs.
But I bet, because we're in America, I bet those seats in the waiting room get plushier and plushier because they're making some serious money off of this production. They're loving it. They're like, oh, I wish this could get... Let's make this a series.
It's like... did you ever play Theme Hospital?
No, is that like a hospital tycoon sort of
thing? Yeah, exactly. And, you know, like, at the start, you've got, like, really basic benches and you've just got, like, one room and that's it at the start of shooting. And then come the end of the... however long the shoot ended up being, plush leather, you know, smells of rich mahogany.
So, believe it or not, turnover on staff was high. Because of Marshall's involvement in The Exorcist, rumours started to spread that the set of Raw was plagued by the curse of The Exorcist, and not the fact that they were just trying to film 70 barely trained lions and 2 elephants.
Yeah. Looking at the animals running havoc and going,
Yeah.
Maybe it's something to do with that spooky film he worked on. As an elephant just like crashes through the wall of a building.
Throws its trainer into a tree.
It's like, God, I had a really weird feeling about that Exorcist movie.
If it wasn't for that, I'm sure this would all be going smoothly.
Yeah.
As if that wasn't enough, the property that all this was being filmed on was flooded in 1978, causing 15 lions and tigers to escape into California, requiring sheriff and local law enforcement to shoot three lions, including the lead lion, Robbie, who then had to be recast.
I tell you who's sick of Ron Oxley's shit. The local sheriff. He is done with that film.
He's so done. The flood happened. 15 lions and tigers escaped. Three were shot, including the leading man, Robbie the Lion. He was recast. It took 8 months to rebuild the set, and then a load of wildfires broke out. It was just, like, we made light of the curse of the Exorcist, but this thing was just absolute carnage from start to finish.
Yeah.
The whole thing took 11 years to actually make. Its budget ballooned to $17 million, and other than being a hit in Germany and Japan, it was an absolute box office flop, making $2 million.
I've just Googled $17 million from 1970 in today's money. Any guess?
$17 million. What are we talking about? Like maybe like $400 million or something like that?
Well, okay, $135 million.
What are films being made for these days? you just seem like a guy that would be able to be like, oh yeah, you know, they made The Dark Knight for this amount of millions.
The big tentpole Marvel ones, the like Endgame and Infinity War, I feel like were $250 million each.
I mean, this is
the not
game
that
of nature.
Yeah,
it's literally the end game of nature.
Well, what do we want to? What have you seen recently?
Wonka was the last thing I went to see.
Firstly, what the fuck?
It's great.
Wonka.
I went to see it at Christmas. Budget. It was lovely.
That was $125 million.
So we're basically talking about a similar level of...
Yeah.
Well, you could make Wonka for less than you made Raw.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So I want now, I think I should ask you actually, like, tell me about watching the film. How did you come to watching it? When did you decide to watch it?
So
what
was
it like?
I watched it in 2016. 2016, mm-hmm. I think. 2015, 2016. And I can't remember exactly how I came across it, because obviously pre-TikTok, but I definitely came across the trailer online, because I don't know if you've since gone and watched the trailer, but it's very particular. It kind of got like re-released, so it came out in the 70s and it, you know, flopped, like you said, but I think it then became a kind of B movie or, you know, urban legend type thing.
Yeah.
And the trailer I saw was connected to that because it had quotes in the trailer, like from movie reviews. And the one I remember is there's a point in the trailer where it just said, like if Swiss Family Robinson was a snuff movie. I remember seeing this trailer on YouTube and I'm like, this looks unbelievable. So I need to track it down. So tracked it down completely legally.
For the purposes of the tape.
Found it and then just invited some mates around and we watched it. And I remember it being just like jaws on the floor the entire time, because I don't think I really like explained to them like what I'd found or what I wanted to watch. Just mental. I mean, when I say like the plot or your thing earlier, if it's just like scene of an animal does this, scene of an animal does this. I mean, I remember like human actors would kind of walk into screen or the camera would be like tracking some humans walking across a field. And then someone would just get taken out by a lion and like that'd be the scene. And then it just jump cut to some next thing. And people like actively trying to deliver lines and give a performance, and then someone would like, they'd literally just be actively batting away a lion whilst trying to have some kind of like anything approach. I mean, heartfelt is too much, but like anything approaching acting.
Yeah,
just the whole time. And like they really should have you know, thought about sticking with lions, lions, and more lions, because fucking hell, the volume of lions. Like, I honestly couldn't tell you what it was about. The start, anything. I just remember people getting taken out by lions, yeah, left, right, and center, and it, yeah, just being anarchy.
Would you like to guess what happened to Noel and Tippy during the production and what happened afterwards? You can probably guess.
Oh, is it divorce?
It's correct. It's divorce. Noel and Tippy grew distant during production.
Oh, did they?
And ended up getting divorced after the 11 years literally fighting lions.
I mean, that will put strain on a marriage.
Noel actually never went on to make another film again, and Tippy went on to found the Raw Foundation and established Shambhala Wildlife Preserve in Soledad County in California, where the animals went to live after the filming. The foundation has now rescued over 200 big cats, and Tippy now campaigns for better protection of these animals' habitats. And that's the story of Raw.
I feel there's one character left unfinished.
Is it Ron Oxley?
And that's the story of Ron Oxley.
Ron Oxley got away scot-free. Like, his name somehow became a footnote, but if you trace it back, he is the enabler in all of this. That's what we need Raw 2. Raw 2 is Raw 2, the Ballad of Ron Oxley.
So, in a last little deep dive on Ron Oxley, it has linked me to a show called Manimal, which I've never heard of before, but I'm going to read you the first line of the Wikipedia. Manimal is an American superhero television series created by blah, 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 that ran for 3 months in 1983. The show centers on the character Jonathan Chase, a shape-shifting man who can turn himself into any animal he chooses. He uses this ability to help the police solve crimes. The series ended after a brief 8-episode run.
Right.
I think we need to track down some more of Ron Oxley's work.
And then how many geese watch party?
Yeah, exactly. Hi, everyone. I'm popping up to say a big thank you to the sponsor of this week's episode, Bearkind Socks. If you don't know about Bearkind Socks, they are bamboo socks working to help wildlife. 10% of profits on every pair are donated to charity, and with so much wildlife under threat, why not just have some better socks that do a bit of good? They're a certified B Corp, partnered with over 30 charities to help the wildlife they're looking to save, from the Australian Wildlife Conservancy through to smaller groups like the Cornwall Seal Group Research Trust. So, if you want to help orangutans, you can head on there and get some jazzy orangutan socks that will help them out. But they've also got whales, they've got giraffes, they've got sea turtles, they've got you name it, it's up there, and there are more animals in the pipeline too that they're looking to help. So, a big thank you from us for Bearkind, and we're going to jump back in with How Many Geese?
It's time for that part of the show where we take one of nature's magnificent creatures and we pit it against Roddy Shaw in a fight to the death. This one is from Autumn Warmth on Instagram, and it is the American Woodcock. Let's get to know our foe. Hailing from the eastern half of North America, the American Woodcock is a member of the wading bird family, which has unusually cut all ties with the water and lives on the ground in woodland and forestry habitats. It can be found in wet, damp ground, but it's not like other wading birds that like to walk around on the edge of shores and things like that. Their colours are a very cryptic mix of browns, greys, blacks to camouflage them into the woodland floor. They're about 30 centimetres long and pretty plump, coming in at 230 grams and a bill that can be up to 7 centimetres long. The bill itself has a very cool mechanism, actually, where when the bill is sunk into the ground, probing for worms, it can still open and close the tip of the upper mandible so that it can grasp onto any prey. So if you imagine, when the bird sticks its beak into the ground, it still needs to be able to open the tip of its beak so it can actually snap onto a worm and pull it out. So it has this mechanism where it can move the end of its lower mandible so it can snap onto a worm and pull it out. Their big eyes are located high on their heads, and they're believed to potentially have the biggest field of vision of any bird. being able to see 360 degrees in the horizontal plane and 180 degrees in the vertical one. They have these huge, big eyes, and they're basically able to see all around them. And finally, the American woodcock is a bit of a viral star for a couple of reasons. On the ground, the male makes a short, buzzing little like beep sound, and there's this video of a male doing that that I have been sent a lot, and I would just like to take this chance to say, people, if you see that video, please, I don't need to see it again. I've seen it a lot. It's very good, but I've seen it quite a lot. And they also do this really unusual rocking behavior when they walk, bouncing their bodies up and down and rocking back and forth. And of course, this one, this is probably even more of a famous video. People have put funky, jazzy music over it to make it look like it's dancing as it's walking along. The actual reason for this behavior is a bit of a mystery and maybe a method of a bird coaxing worms to the surface by causing vibrations in the ground. Or it could be a way of the woodcock signaling to any other potential predators and letting them know that they've been spotted. It's basically saying, there's no point trying to kill me because I've seen you there and I'm showboating and I'm doing this little rocking motion so that you know that I've seen you. Sometimes the woodcock will flash their white under tail feathers whilst doing this rocking, drawing even more attention to themselves and so supporting the theory that they are signalling to a predator that there's no point in them trying to make the kill because the woodcocks know that they're there. So, Roddy Shaw, with all that in mind, how many woodcock are too many woodcock?
I want to be very clear here. Very clear. This bird is silly.
It is. Absolutely.
Like, I've been looking at pictures of it. It's kind of like a Christmas pudding, like leaf in camouflage, like the sort of hunter's camo jacket.
Yes.
If you put that on a Christmas pudding, just a little dumpy kind of with sort of, yeah, the two weird eyes stuck on the top and then stuck a, you know.
Like a big long beak.
Yeah.
It's like chopsticks. Exactly. Like two chopsticks.
Exactly.
Put together.
Exactly. You could, this, if I was in Bake Off, and they asked me to prepare, you know, like, ooh, make a cake that looks like a blah, blah. Making a cake that looked like a woodcock would be low effort. It's just a dumpy little dumpy dump. I will add to my case that the woodcock is silly, American woodcock is silly, by sharing with you some folk names for the bird, which I don't know if you saw, but I've got it pulled up here. We've got Timberdoodle, silly. Bogsucker, silly. Hokumpoke.
Fantastic.
Hokumpoke, silly. Then the last two, night partridge, less silly. Brush snipe, less silly again.
Okay. I've heard Timberdoodle. That's what I've heard.
Timberdoodle's fun. Yeah. Right. I'll also say, again, so I've, you know, Jack goes through his thing and every now and then if I'm completely unfamiliar, I'll pull up a picture so I can familiarise myself. And this one's got a couple statistics with it that just says that the population of American woodcock has fallen by an average of slightly more than 1% annually since the 60s. Most authorities attribute this decline to a loss of habitat. Next point. It is also a popular game bird with about 500,000 killed annually.
Maybe should we connect the dots there?
Yeah. Because if we go further, it even says that... Oh, I can't remember. It is more tolerant of deforestation than other woodcocks. So to say that the population decline is due to a loss of habitat, whilst also saying it's tolerant of deforestation, and also saying that hunters are killing 500,000 annually, I might be able to join those dots up for the IUCN. You mentioned its spectacular field of vision.
Yes.
And I think this has to be at the forefront of our minds.
Yeah, it's going to make it tricky to sneak up on it.
To sneak up on it. But I'm assuming it's not good from below.
No.
We must attack from beneath, which is a real shame because...
They're tiny.
Well, that, but also I'm not, you know, the most subterraneanly...
Unless you're, like, popping out of the Vietnam-style tunnels.
Oh, do we work with the Viet Cong to take down the American woodcocks?
There's a precedent.
Is this going to land us in hot water?
They probe into the ground as well. Maybe just grab their little beaks and...
Oh, and what? Pull them? Yeah. Oh, like a sort of... But
things are being pulled into the ground.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, when they're sticking their beaks in.
Yeah.
Just grab them, pull them in.
Okay. I mean, they're already getting hammered by the hunters.
Yeah.
$500,000 a year.
It's a lot.
It's a lot, isn't it?
It's a lot.
Just,
yeah.
Do you need them?
No. We've got chickens for that.
Are they, I mean, I'm guessing they're edible.
Yeah, we there's European woodcock.
Yeah.
And people still shoot those.
What's the difference between a woodcock and a snipe?
Different genus of birds and snipes. Snipe tend to prefer... snipe are found closer to wetlands and more boggy areas in general. Woodcock are unusual in that they are this wading bird that has completely shunned water a lot of the time and just live right in the middle of forests.
So do I need to flood a forest?
If like, yeah, they wouldn't like it too
damp.
No.
Hmm.
They'd like damp ground because they're able to put their beaks in. So they do a mass migration from the north and the very, very northern parts. They'll breed there in the summer. But then the ground freezes solid and they can't get their long beaks in. They actually can't probe into the ground. So both American woodcock and European woodcock migrate south.
Yep.
Or we get a lot coming here from Russia and places like that.
Yep.
To overwinter here so that they can actually physically just get their beaks in the soil because it's too frozen. So in America, the American woodcock migrates south to escape the sort of boreal forests of Canada where it gets too cold.
Could I stop them migrating?
Just put a big net up.
Yeah, hold them hostage in the frozen tundra?
One of the things that they do as well on their migration is they regularly fly into buildings. In fact, did you...
Yes.
Send me a picture of one that your family had found or a friend had found. You found it.
Buildings near me in London at the bottom of... When's migration time?
It'll be generally autumn or spring. It's usually autumn migration.
Yeah, I think it was the spring.
Yeah.
I feel like it was the spring that I saw that, but yeah. And actually, complete sidebar, but there is a fantastic episode of the podcast Radio Lab, which is all about the impacts of like high-rise buildings on migrating birds.
Yeah.
So... I would strongly recommend anyone go check that out.
Yeah.
Now we'll return to working out how many we can kill in addition to the 500,000 being murdered by...
Yeah, and then on top of that, the ones that fly into buildings.
Yeah, and the ones that get stuck in the frozen tundra and can't probe the ground.
Yeah. It's amazing there's any left, isn't it, actually?
It really is. When you really stack the deck against them, or when the deck is stacked against them that strongly, the fact that this Christmas pudding of an animal is able to survive solely off the back of... Maybe all that's keeping them going is the viral media sensation-ness of that. Maybe I need to combat that.
They have become a bit of a thing.
So maybe it's a case of... Yeah, sort of. How do you get videos taken down? Can you claim?
Oh, you'd have to click. Well, so their most famous videos are the ones of them dancing.
The bobbing walk.
So it's them doing this walk and the funky music. Who owns that funky music?
Oh.
Copyright claim.
It's a legal proceeding.
Yeah.
We're taking them to court.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to... Yes.
I highly doubt the woodcock produced that funky jazz.
No. And whoever does may not know... The level of, you know, attention, the revenue that they could be getting, which is otherwise going to propping up the woodcock population, which by all accounts should be crumbling. So I think it's that. I think we need a legal case to combat their viral success. And once they've lost that, there's nothing.
Yeah.
And then it's just extinction. So it's whatever woodcock are left... After the 500,000 have been taken by the hunters, the dead ones from the migration, and the ones stuck in the frozen tundra. Whatever's left after that, I'm bringing down through legal means.
Probably about four.
Yeah. Okay, we're here with a question. And this question comes to us, one of the few questions which has been delivered... Hand-delivered. Personally delivered.
Ooh.
Comes to us from my sister.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she asked... Now, it comes to us from my sister and then bounces off my dad for what I'm going to pitch.
Right, okay.
Yeah. My sister asked, if you could save any five animals, what would they be?
Right.
My dad adapted it, and I think this is the one, to, in a Noah's Ark sense...
Yeah.
Elon Musk is calling, there's plants and shit on Mars, right? And we have to like man a rocket with five species to rejig the planet.
Right.
What are you sending?
So, for example, my take was, if we just had five, but you basically almost want to have like a food chain there.
So we're talking their value to humans.
I think it's their value in literally, for example, antelopes have never made it on our board, really, right? But I think maybe from an ecosystem sense, are they something that you want as like a founding, like the Pilgrims of America, the founding, you know, who are the founding animals?
Are we ruling out domestic animals? Because they're the answer, aren't they?
We're ruling out domestic.
Okay.
This is, yeah, maybe it's not Mars. Maybe it's a new continent has appeared on Earth.
Okay.
Yeah. A new continent has appeared, a new country has appeared on Earth, and we want to seed it
with
a sort of ecosystem.
But it's got plants, it's got trees, it's got
plants and trees. And all that sort so of from a very science point of view, the producers are all there.
Right. Okay.
You know.
Okay.
We've got trees and berries, but like, who's your top pollinator? Maybe.
Yeah. So that's what I'm thinking of, those services.
Exactly. Yeah. You know. So, for example, we could stick hummingbirds there.
Yes.
As a pollinator.
Yeah.
But I don't think they're doing... It's almost who are the most multi-talented.
Exactly. They're two specialists.
They're two specialists.
Yeah.
Whereas you've got things like bats, which pollinate and seed disperse.
Yes.
But I think still...
I think still there's insects that... there must be... Bees must pollinate more types of flowers than bats or birds do. Because... like, there's lots of flowers that are just open daisy-type flowers. And bats and birds aren't doing those.
Yeah, okay.
Rather than the long tubular ones.
Yeah. And then, for example, and this is where, you know, the whole Save the Panda thing.
Right.
They're not on the... They're
no, they're not.
Yeah,
no.
They're...
No. We will need... I was thinking we wouldn't need one of these, but I think we will. I was thinking we wouldn't need a predator.
Yeah.
But we will need a predator.
Yeah.
Or we have the UK. And no trees can grow because we've got too many deer. Okay.
So it's the question, how do we avoid becoming the UK?
Yeah. So we will need a top-down predator to help whatever herbivore we decide.
Yes.
Okay. We're going to need a pollinator.
We need a pollinator. We need a predator. Yeah. We need a herbivore. Mm-hmm. And then what are the other two? Something's pollinating the plants. Something's eating the plants. Something's eating that thing so it doesn't get out of hand. A decomposer? But that could be a mushroom. Let's say the mushroom's already there.
Yeah, because I was thinking that. We've got fungi.
Fungi are there. So who's our top pollinator? Who's our top herbivore? Our best predator?
I think the pollinator is going to have to be something like a bee because butterflies, moths... are great, but... or maybe a moth.
We need an insectivore.
Yeah.
Because we don't want... we need to keep that in check.
Yeah.
And then we need...
so maybe...
our good time party animal.
Maybe we need... okay, I think let's start with a pollinator. Depending on what pollinator we go for will depend on what insectivore we choose.
Yeah.
Because if we choose moths, we need bats.
Yeah.
If we choose bees, we could do with bee eaters.
Yes.
So it's going to depend on... and I think for us, it has to be bees because they make honey and moths don't.
Okay. Oh, we're on the island.
I thought we were...
okay, yeah. Okay. All right, yeah. Yeah, let's add that in the mix. Yeah, okay, cool.
I think if it's making it... yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And then honey feeds other things and stuff as well, doesn't it? So
yeah, so in a million years when stuff evolves out. Because I think that's... in the back of my head, that's another bit.
Yeah.
Is where does this go down the line?
Yeah.
So, okay, bees are on the board.
Bees, some sort of bee.
Right, let's tackle what's eating them.
Yeah.
Bee eaters are a pretty obvious one,
but a lot of insectivorous birds would... do. Are there any that would then also eat fruit?
What does a honey buzzard do?
Honey buzzards are... I actually was watching a video on Reels last night.
Yep.
It got something like 100 and something million views. and it was of a oriental honey buzzard.
Were you jealous?
My nemesis. It was amazing footage of an oriental honey buzzard just diving in head first into this. You know how sometimes bee nests just hang from the underside of branches?
Yep.
And you have all the bees covering the comb and stuff like that. And the honey buzzard just dove straight in there and was chomping on all the... What honey buzzards like to eat is they eat the larvae from the bee and wasp nests. That's what they're after. And it was just diving in there and it was amazing. So they could be a fun one.
Yeah.
They're not really doing much food dispersal, but they're cool. Fruit dispersal, but they're cool. But then maybe if we have... a herbivore that can do that. What if our herbivore isn't a big grazer, but it's something like a baboon?
Okay.
Because that will eat everything.
I think yes. I don't want to live on an island with a baboon. But what about like kinkajou? What do they do?
Yeah. Are they a bit small to act on the ecosystem level, though?
Yeah.
I feel like baboon is about as small as you can go, where I feel like their grazing activity would still do something.
Do deer eat berries?
I think probably.
I think it's got to be some kind of
antelope-y.
Oh, no, a goat.
A goat.
Goat eat everything.
What about an acarpy? What do they eat? That'd be fun to put them on there, wouldn't it?
Yes.
They eat fruit. They must eat fruit.
They must eat fruit.
They must eat fruit.
They must eat fruit. If they don't, they do now. Okay.
And it would be cool just to have a carpies roaming around.
Yes.
But that be your herbivore.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and also, again, if we're there, you know, you're getting a lot of meat off an acarpy.
That is true.
Do you think you could domesticate an acarpy? Befriend it? Acarpy milk?
It's worth a shot, isn't it?
Yeah.
They are cool.
And
I bet they do taste good.
And from a kickstarting evolution sense.
Oh, who knows where that's
who knows where that's
literally
going.
Spin the wheel.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, cool. Right. Bees on the board.
Okay.
Herbivore/frugivore/seed disperser. Acarpy on the board. And I bet there's some kind of eco. It's going to trample things through the forest. It will break a tree down, so it's going to do a bit of that stuff.
Another thing we could have thought of. Acarpy, I think, is the answer. But some sort of wild pig would have been great.
Yeah,
because they eat everything. They disturb the ground. They're a good...
Like a peccary?
Yeah, something like that. They're pretty important in... They create mud wallows and things like that. I bet a carpy wallow as well. They look like something that wallow.
I'm sure they wallow.
Yeah, if they don't, they do now.
I'm going to say four hooves wallow is a surefire path to wallow.
So if we've got a carpy, then we're sort of narrowing down now.
Yeah.
We've got to have a predator that can take down an acarpy. Have you ever seen an acarpy?
They're big.
They're big.
Yeah.
They're surprisingly big.
I know. They are gorgeous, though.
Yeah, it's stunning. Like, just velvety and they've got the sheen to them. Yeah, they're really cool.
Okay.
So, we're going to need a predator that can take down an acarpy.
Well, it's cats, dogs, or bears.
Yeah, okay.
Right.
Bears can also fulfill seed dispersal and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. But I reckon the only bear that can bring down an acarpy is a grizzly or a polar.
Yeah.
And that's a terrifying existence we've made for ourselves.
If we're not there, maybe grizzly bear is the one.
Is the one. Because that's also big enough to mash up the ecosystem a bit.
Yeah.
That'll do some wallers. Okay, so bears on the board.
I think grizzly bear.
Let's just work through it. Dogs, it's going to have... Do you think African wild dogs?
Could take down a carpy.
I mean, they're very cool as well.
They are very cool. But could they take down an acarpy?
Can they take down an eland?
I'm trying to think of what they hunt.
It's big. They're the most successful predator in Africa.
Yeah. The highest...
Their hit rate is... Yeah. Yeah. Bonkers.
Percentage chance.
Yeah.
So we do want some acarpy left, so maybe not.
Yes. That's true. Yeah. We want something which is going to have a miss from time to time.
Like the bears will eat the acarpy if they get the chance, but they'll also eat a lot of the other things.
Yeah.
Wolves would take down acarpies.
Wolves would take down acarpies, definitely. And we know that wolves, from an ecosystem engineer perspective, the Yellowstone, a handful of wolves, the trick... Because we don't want these acarpy getting out of hand.
No, we don't. We don't want to be knee-deep
in acarpy. But yeah, I think wolves.
Okay.
Okay.
Wolves.
And big cats as well. No, because I'm thinking to you here, you don't want to kickstart a planet full of cats.
Oh, absolutely not. No.
So we're ending that evolutionary.
Yeah. I think if we're on the island, wolves are less danger to us than bears.
And give it time, we're domesticating dogs again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bees are carpies, wolves. Now we need something to handle the bees. Are we sticking with honey buzzard?
Oh, honey buzzard is cool, but it's just a bit, it doesn't sort of fit into the web.
Yeah.
But, oh yeah, it's our island.
Okay.
What about the fifth one? Something in the water.
Honey buzzard.
A fish.
Oh. A freshwater fish.
Well, I'm thinking if it's an island, then...
Oh, what about...
Then we need to populate the freshwater, because the sea around it will have life, let's just say.
Okay, what about some kind of crustacean?
Right.
Like, well, I mean... I was really hoping you'd immediately spring to life with something. I was just thinking like a freshwater crab.
Yeah.
That, because they...
We're going to need something to eat the freshwater crab. I think we have to have... I think we have to have bears or pigs. Because they will eat anything. And I think you could... If you throw in a freshwater mollusk, bears are going to go and eat them. Pigs have been seen in the UK where they've done these rewilding projects... They, at Knepp in Sussex, where they did the big rewilding project and they've got the Tamworth pigs roaming around, they watch the pigs diving into the water and coming up with like swan mussels from the bottom of the water that they are now allowed to roam into. So I think everything needs to...
So if we take the wolves out and we put the bears in,
yeah,
and then our fifth thing is a freshwater mussel.
Well, it could be. But whatever you add, what's the thing that's controlling it is what I'm thinking, you know?
Yes.
I think the centre, if we were coming at this from a very scientific perspective and trying to complete as many ecosystem niches in one go,
yeah,
you would have bear instead of wolf, you would have pig instead of a carpy.
Yeah, but a carpy's so jazzy.
But a carpy's so cool. But for goose, yeah, for goose things, I think we should use a carpy.
Yeah.
But if you were doing this from like a scientific perspective, I think you'd want pig and bear. Because
yeah.
They do everything.
Do everything.
Yeah. They eat everything and they disturb stuff and they whatever. But I think we should go for a carpy.
Yeah.
And let's chuck the wild dogs in there.
Well, hang on then.
If we're going goose version.
Let's change it up in a slight other way. Instead of five, let's do six.
Okay.
So we've got bees, something controlling the bees. Mm. We've got herbivore, something controlling the herbivore. And then we need freshwater, something controlling the freshwater thing.
Okay, so like a freshwater thing and then a predator.
Yeah, so like
okay.
Fish and kingfisher.
Yeah.
So I think, what needs to happen in freshwater?
Well, actually, I was thinking when you said mussel,
yeah.
The filtering of
yeah.
Like that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I think that because we don't want to get them full of bear shit.
No. So maybe we do need mussels, like pearl mussels.
Yeah.
Pearl mussels, then we got pearls there.
Yeah, that's nice.
Freshwater pearl mussel.
Yep, and we can make a nice necklace for the okapi.
Yeah.
That'd be nice. And we need something. So what eats mussels? If not, because we got wolves. So what eats mussels?
What eats mussels?
Oh, when there's like macaques? Crab eating macaque? Do we want to live there?
Macaque. They could do a lot of other things as well.
Yeah.
Depends how deep the water is.
I'd live with a small monkey.
Yeah.
Wait, what does eat a mussel? Primary predators of freshwater mussels are muskrats, otters,
okay.
Raccoon,
oh.
Fish, broad, flatworms, ducks, or... geese.
Oh.
It has
wow.
to be.
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
got
there are some species of geese that, yeah.
Freshwater mussels and whatever goose eats them.
And if I'm right in thinking, the geese that eat mussels are quite nice geese.
Yeah.
They're little, small, cute ones.
Yeah.
They're not hissing, honking annoyances.
But then the goose island.
Yeah.
Its complete. Totem is complete.
Yeah.
Okay. Bees, okapi, wolves, honey buzzard, freshwater mussels, and geese. Is all you need to kickstart life on Earth.
And that was this week's episode of How Many Geese. Thank you very much for listening. Big thank you if you've been telling your friends and sharing it far and wide. We really appreciate it, and all the tags on Instagram help a huge deal too. A massive welcome if you are a new listener, and thank you for coming back to us if you are returning this week. If you want to help the podcast out, hop on over to iTunes, and if you can leave a written review, it massively helps with the algorithm, or go over to Spotify and leave a review there too. Don't forget, there's the Instagram page to check out at How Many Geese. And if you are feeling extra generous, you can head over to buymeacoffee.com/How Many Geese and leave us a little tip if you're enjoying what we do. Thanks very much. We'll be back next week with more How Many Geese. Cheers. Bye-bye. God, I said How Many Geese a lot.